Bills first. Senator Remmel, Senate File 773. These are, just for members' edification, these are two agency. Senator Remmel's bill is an agency bill. Senator Phoebe's bill is a suggestion coming out of townships. It appears that Bowser doesn't have a problem with them. What we're going to do is have, there will be an environment policy bill that I think we will roll these two Bowser bills into. And I've spoken with Mr. Jaski and the authors, as well as my House counterparts, and they appear to be supportive of that process as well. And because they're particularly with Senate File 773, there are a lot of ins and outs that'll give us a chance to soak it in. And if there are any issues, we can work on them. But Bowser's agency bills have generally been pretty copacetic. So that was the intent with at least these two bills. And I think the authors are fine with that. In general, members, if as we did with the Fredrickson bill on Monday, if an author truly wants their bill to travel on its own or be dual-tracked, contrary to previous two sessions, I don't have a problem with that. So that would be the explanation why the Fredrickson bill continued on, even though it didn't need to be heard in any other committees. The game and fish bills, if it doesn't need to be heard in another committee, just in coordination with my House counterpart, we would prefer them all to be in one game and fish bill. And then what we'll do is if there are stops that a bill needs to make for local government and in the local government committee, and there might be some provisions in some upcoming bills for judiciary, what I think we'll do is instead of sending bills off and then having them come back, what we've discussed is just putting them all in the environment policy bill, so then that one environment policy omnibus bill can go to judiciary, go to state and local government, and so that they can all just make one stop. Now, if you're passionately against that for your bill, talk to us. That's fine. But that's kind of the discussions we've been having just for process. And we've coordinated everything so that with our bill and the House so that everything will make deadline. Just wanted to, for process sake. But for these two Bowser bills today, we'll just lay them over for consideration in the omnibus policy bill and then make the rule stop with the larger bill. And then if you have any objections, you want to think about it and have any objections to it later on, talk to us and we'll work with you. Senate File 773.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. As the chair suggested or said, the bill I'm carrying, 773, is an agency bill. Before we proceed to an explanation of the bill, I'd like to author, because this is the first time the bill is being heard, offer an author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Pass out the A1.
And this amendment puts the bill in the form that we think it needs to go. This amendment, basically, it's a technical change that corrects a mistake that was in the original drafting of the bill. Mr. Jaski probably can answer the questions about the technicality.
Senator Scogin will move the A1.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Remmel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to give you the shorthand of how I understand this bill. It provides some technical changes that aligns the legislation in statute with what is current practice. So the statute, the way it's written today, is not the way things have been typically done over the last number of years. And so the bill aligns the statute with what is current practice. And Mr. Jaski can walk you through the bill piece by piece.
Thank you. And I did ask Mr. Jaski just to give us a, because there's so many kind of statute references and repealers, to give us a little bit more detail on what each one of those means, so something doesn't slip through that we don't know about. Mr. Jaski, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much. John Jaski, Executive Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. And we've had a chance in the previous meeting of this committee and also in Senator Bickerman's committee to overview the Reinvest in Minnesota program and the things that we accomplished with that program, which is one of the most successful in the country in terms of getting wetlands restored and buffers installed along our riparian areas. And that's what the program does. As Senator Rummel mentioned, over the years since this law was passed, we've done things differently. And that doesn't mean that we haven't been following law. What that simply means is that in the appropriations that have been directed to this program, there's been language that has been included that allows certain exceptions and accommodations from this underpinning statute, which you see here in front of you in Minnesota Statute 103F. This statute was originally passed in about 1986, I believe, and Mr. Kevin Lyons is here. Kevin is our program administrator, so for something that I can't quite answer correctly or need more information, he's here to help with that. There were also some changes made, I believe, in the early 1990s, which included putting in a number of details about payment rates, which, of course, in retrospect, was not a good way to do statutory writing because those dollar amounts and things need to perpetually be updated. And so we've got other mechanisms in place to substitute for that. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll walk through the changes on page 2, lines 1 through 8. What this does is simply include the additional functions that these projects, again, the wetland restorations and riparian grassland buffers that the program focuses on, accomplish, recognizing the science that has been achieved over those last couple of decades to show what these programs or these projects accomplish on the ground. Just making it more modern, I guess, is simply the way to put it, in line with the science. On page 2, again, down to line 2.12 and through 2.14, this is a outdated provision that lined up with some, at the new at the time, federal farm bill legislation, which addressed alterations to wetlands in particular, known as a swamp buster provision. This is no longer relevant or necessary. That farm bill has been updated many times since that 1985 date. On line 2.17, 2.18, just in another place, we refer to the program by name, and this is the name or the moniker that has been used for the program for a number of decades, and you'll see later on we're clarifying why that program name is now being clarified in statute. On line 2.21 and 2.22, riparian land has definitions that are described here, but they're identified not just in this one particular kind of plan, but in many local plans or even statewide plans, and so it's just allowing flexibility in terms of where the definition of riparian land comes from, which not an important detail, but it's giving some flexibility as to where those priority sites are located and which plans support those. Line 2.24 through 2.30, what this does is making sure the name change is clarified. The program, for whatever reason, back in 1986 or 85, was called the Conservation Reserve Program in some cases, as well as a Reinvest in Minnesota program. And that name has been utilized subsequent to that by the federal government, and they have their own Conservation Reserve Program, which has been confusing to some over the years, because if you read the statute, you may have thunk that they were the same thing, and they're not. So we're making that clear. And then also, again, down the line 2.28 through 2.29, just adding a few more details about some of the conservation benefits the program provides. On the top of page 3, again, back just to the name change, on line 3.8, we're talking about some of the land that's eligible, and we're just adding a clarification that water quality improvement is a part of establishing a windbreak, that that's the primary purpose for those windbreaks, not for other perhaps aesthetic purposes only. And we've talked in this committee about the water quality benefits that are derived from the program.
Mr. Jasky, is Reinvest in Minnesota, is that the title of the program? And as such, should it be capitalized on 2.25 and 2.8?
Mr. Chairman, I'll leave that to your counsel as to whether it should be capitalized or not.
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, I think in whenever it's been referred to or in a memo or something like that, it would be capitalized. But in statute, we have some very strange rules sometimes on what's capitalized and what's not. And generally, programs are not capitalized.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, then members back on to page 3, line 3.17. There are sensitive areas that may be eligible for enrollment that are associated with a pasture land that may not be on a hillside. Sometimes we have seeps or wetland areas that are part of pastures, and some of that land may also be included as ancillary enrolled land in the program. Line 3.22 and 3.23 is simply taking out the title of an agency that has been changed since the time that this law was originally established. It's now known as the U.S. Department of Agriculture Farm Services Agency, but at that point, it doesn't really matter who defines it. We have those definitions that are already in state statute, and we utilize those federal definitions where they're helpful, but they're not necessary. On line, I guess we're just talking again, next one is just about the name change again on line 3.25. And then on line 3.30, just adding in the term environmentally sensitive areas, we also have used the program to secure easements on sensitive groundwater recharge areas, sinkhole areas, things like that that are environmentally sensitive but may not otherwise be defined. Line 3.32 through 3.33, again, taking out some language which is no longer relevant tied to the federal farm bill that was passed back in 1985. And, page 4, line 4.6 through 4.11, we do allow through the management plans that go with these conservation easements. And again, the program is underpinned by state conservation easements, which, you know, protect and preserve the water quality, habitat, and other functions. There are some details that are included in a management plan that goes with each of these easements that describes the practices that can occur on that site. And there are, on limited occasions, opportunities for, you know, limited grazing to actually substitute for burning the material, or in some cases we allow harvesting for that same purpose as long as it doesn't devalue the primary purposes, which are water quality and habitat. Then on line 4.8 to 4.11, we're just taking out that outdated language, which basically prohibited that without some management plan authorizing it, which is what we've accomplished in the lines just above there. Line 4.12 through 4.14, again, you know, it talks about the prohibiting of spraying with chemicals, but in certain cases, we do utilize that technique to eradicate invasives or other undesirable species and get those plant communities reestablished into natives.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Federer.
Chairman, Mr. Jasky, I have a question about the section that's being deleted on 4.8 to 4.11. Mm-hmm. We're striking the in case of severe drought our local emergency. Mm-hmm. So if we would have a severe drought again by striking this, would this eliminate grazing or producing hay off of RIM from being an alternative?
Mr. Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, it would not. What we've done is whenever a federal disaster declaration has been declared for an area, the board is then considers allowing this use of those lands on an emergency basis for haying and grazing, and this would not prohibit the board from doing that. It just doesn't explicitly state it, and if it felt it's important that it be remaining in there, I think that's fine. The question that comes up, though, is it's currently limited just to this section 12.29 And there may be other reasons why a disaster declaration would be declared, and the board may want to open up these areas for that purpose on an emergency basis. So we can do it without the language, but if it's important to preserve it, I think that would be something you could consider.
Senator Frederickson, it looks like current law requires the board approval, consultation with the DNR, and then in case of severe drought, a local emergency. So this proposal would streamline that to simply the board allowing that grazing to happen. So it seemed like it would not only not prohibit it, but actually enhance that ability if the need occurred.
Mr. Chairman, my concern is with, I guess, be paragraph 2, you know, starting up at subdivision 4, conservation easement must prohibit agricultural crop production and livestock grazing, and then it carves out one exception, and that's specifically approved by the board for conservation management purposes.
Okay.
And feeding hungry livestock in a drought situation would not be for conservation management. That's my concern.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, is there any harm in, you know, making it clear by leaving it in if the board doesn't have to consult with the Commissioner of Natural Resources, just delete that portion of it, and then it would essentially affirm what you believe is the authority, but it would let people working with the law know that.
Or on line 7, you could, after purposes, include or severe drought. How would that sound, Senator Frederickson?
I'm looking through this. That occurred to me, too, Mr. Chairman, that would work. I'm also trying to wend my way through that paragraph 3 to see if that could be reinstated without the antiquated references.
Should we just kind of mull over that for a moment, and we'll make sure to come back to that issue?
Mr. Chairman, just to make a point on that.
Knopf.
I think that you wouldn't want to reinstitute the stricken language in Clause 3 there, because now you're putting the prohibition on livestock grazing is in 2, so I think the chair had it right. But I think you need to make the exception in Clause 2, because that's now where the grazing prohibition exists. So rather than reinstating the stricken language, I think it would make more sense to just add something to Clause 2, unless you want to reform it, go all the way back and take the language out of Clause 2. You'd have to do that, too.
Should we just add the or severe drought after purposes on line 7, Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, I that's what I'm thinking.
Okay. So Senator Frederickson moves on line 4.7, after the word purposes, insert or severe drought. Everyone understand that?
Senator Olson? Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, weren't you referring to something on page 2?
No, Mr. Chairman, I meant Clause 2 if I said page 2.
Oh, Clause 2. All right. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if we should pick up that whole phrase that says, in the case of severe drought or a local emergency. Still be up to the board.
Well, I mean, if you add local emergency declared under 12.29, that becomes a little more restrictive. If you just say or severe drought, then the board has more flexibility. They don't have to say, well, there's not an emergency declared, so we can't allow it. Okay. Frederickson Amendment. Everyone understand? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Okay. Mull it over some more. I mean, if we need to come back to it, we will. But I think, according to research,
we've solved the problem.
That seems to have solved it. But we can come back to it if people have additional thoughts. Mr. Jaski? Excuse me, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaski, I just want to ask you a quick question. I don't know if you've talked with people in the AG's office. How does this affect existing easements that are applied? Would this be only prospective in the future, or would it be, because it, you know, it's basically when you're, I mean, it's a transaction's occurred, you've acquired certain rights under the easement, and so would these changes only affect future easements, and how is that, have you thought about how that's going to work?
Mr. Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Greg, there is a presumption that it applies to all easements within the area that has had the disaster declaration. So that's the way we've interpreted it and the way we've applied it in previous years.
But no, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Jaskey, what I'm trying to ask is the existing language from the law prior to this, if this change is made, stated certain things that we're acquiring, because it's nature of property rights acquired. So those pre-existing easements, those ones you already have out there, would have been under the law as it reads today. The new ones will be under the new ones. So will you be managing them differently? I'm just trying to figure out how that's going to work for existing easements when you're changing this now and the contract's already been made and the property rights
you're
transferred.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Knopf, you're talking about the whole package of potential changes. Would we be applying any of those retroactively to existing easements?
Well, Mr. Chairman, especially this one, I'm most concerned about Subdivision 4 because that's what was in existence when you acquired these rights to this land. And so any changes that are made now would seem to only apply to new easements.
Mr. Jaskey, is the intent to redraft contracts that already exist
Mr.
after
Chairman,
we change this?
The intent was that these provisions would apply to all easements, current and future, and the way that they would be applied is in amendments to the management plan that goes with each easement. So the easement wouldn't be altered, the rights wouldn't be changed here. It would only be if the management plan was amended, which takes both the landowner and the state to agree to that change before it can be made.
I was thinking about that, whether there would be any onerous impact on the actual legal contracts as opposed to just the management thereof. Mm-hmm. Let's keep that in the back of our minds.
Contract.
Yeah, that's what I'm a little concerned about, yeah.
Mr. Jaskey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, on page 5 then, this is actually one of the more substantial changes here is that I alluded to this earlier, that in the statute, and I don't know exactly when, but we believe it was in the early 90s, there were a number of very prescriptive details about the payment rates for both the easement and the various practices and the percentages of those that would all get applied to a particular site. And as you can imagine, these numbers have all become outdated, and we've been in the last decade and a half getting exceptions to this in each of the appropriation bills that authorize funding for the program. And the way they've done that is in those previous bills is to allow the board to establish rates based on market factors. But if you see in line 5.9 through 5.11, the principal piece of data that's used is the market value of property that the Commissioner of Revenue establishes on a per township basis. So they do that for agricultural land and non-agricultural land, and the board uses that as its basis for establishing these payment rates. So I just wanted to let you know that that's still going to be used as the basis, but these prescriptive details would be no longer needed, and the board would establish the payment rates by board policy using those factors. And on the top of page 6, Mr. Chairman and members, this one is not just a technical change. It's a little bit of a policy change, so you'll have to consider it in that light. If you recall, there is a provision that was added in statute 2 years ago that defined the definitions of restored prairie and restored native prairie and so forth and some ecoregion boundaries for where the seed could be sourced for those restoration projects. And since then, we've been given flexibility that is exactly this language in the appropriation bills for both the Reinvest in Minnesota program as well as other programs to allow some flexibility from those real hard boundaries that are based on county lines and ecoregions that allow us to source seed more flexibly where we can justify the need to go beyond those boundaries. And we have a process in place to do that. And so what we're seeking here is simply the institution of that flexibility in policy rather than trying to always include it into appropriation language going forward. So I want to let you know that is a more of a policy issue that allows the board flexibility. We currently have, mind you, but it will expire when the appropriation language goes away.
We're going to shed light on this issue on Monday.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump has a bill, and so we're going to present science, what the real issues are, and mm-hmm. kind of clear the confusion.
Okay. So again, this is, I don't want to repeat, this is, it is policy change, but it does reflect the current authorization that we have in the appropriation language for the program. And then on to line 6.7, 6.8 is just language clarification that talks about when there's payment rates that can go beyond that for exceptional circumstances where we do an appraisal and so forth and can make the case for a payment rate that's beyond those standards that we talked about earlier of average township market value. Down in line 6.16, 6.17 is just taking out the outdated language regarding the portion of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They still continue to be listed there as a coordination group. We also list the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and Watershed Districts, which are both local organizations that are involved in the program and have been since the get-go. Onto line 6.24, we're just striking the word bond proceeds there simply because the program can be funded from other sources, although historically, in most cases, it has been funded with bonding dollars. And then down on the line 6.26, 6.27 is just taking out some specific language that relates to federal programs. We certainly do everything we can to leverage federal dollars with this program, and we've done that successfully last year and in years prior, and expect to do it into the future. We've talked to you about that in other committees, but this just gives us, you know, the more flexible programs the feds might come up with. We want to be able to target those and leverage their funding, whatever program it's within. 6.29, what this does is just allows for lands that have been enrolled in a program to allow wildlife food plots on them under the conservation easement, you know, as part of that management plan. And that's just updating some language that was previously in there and being a little more clear about where that detail goes. And then on rulemaking, on the top of page 7.3 through 7.5, we currently have rules in place that are antiquated, and we'll talk more down below that those are being proposed for repeal. If rules are important in the future, we still retain that authority, but we have implemented the program via board policy to supplant the statute, or to support the statute in making that program work.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jaski, I'd like to hear a little bit more about where you think you would use the authority of the board may adopt policy.
Sure.
Because generally we don't allow that kind of, you know, that kind of authority. Like years ago, we repealed the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources of ability to do commissioner orders. They have to do expedited rules.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, one of those places is when the board already has the authority. For example, back on page 5.6, the payment rates, line 5.6 through 5.11. We also talked about the allowing, in the cases of a drought or emergency, those areas to be grazed or harvested. The board will institute those provisions via board policy. Because the payment rates, you know, you can't really put them in statute or rule because they are constantly in flux. We can't exactly predict when a drought will occur, but the board would make that call, and that would be a policy implementation the way we would view it.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jaski, when the board does take an action by policy directive, is there a time lag before it becomes effective? How is the public going to be aware of the policy that they're setting if they don't have to go through a rules process?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, first of all, of course, any policy has to be within the confines of the statute, which is here, and within the confines of the appropriation language, which has been very directive each time this program has been funded. Our board, of course, has public notices and for each of all of its meetings and committee meetings, and there's an opportunity for participation in those meetings. Once the policies are adopted, they're effective the date that the board identifies as them being effective, and that could be the day after the board meeting, for example. So there is a process for input prior to the decision, but as far as notice goes, we would provide that notice to the local governments, the soil and water districts principally, who will implement the program.
I'll think about that a little more, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'll continue on, Mr. Chairman. On line 7.7 and 7.8, 7.8 was just taking out old language, which you know, has been subsequently, we still have that authority to alter, release, or terminate these conservation easements. We obviously want to be able to do that as going forward, not stuck on a particular date. The 7.9 is just cleaning up the language, I think. As Mr. Knopf indicated earlier, things are typically not titled. Maybe that's mistaken. If it is, you can fix it. And then on line 7.13 through 7.16, just cleaning up all the name references that occur in various places in the statute. And then onto the repealers. Let me just turn to my connections here. We've got, first of all, I should point out that the one on line 7.19 was the one that was deleted by the author's amendment. That was just an error in the sense that it was going to strike a provision that was not part of the RIM program, even though it's in that RIM program statute. So it would just happen to be located in the wrong place. The other repealer simply removed the requirement for a specific technical assistance provision, which is outdated now. It basically required our agency, along with DNR, to provide certain technical startup assistance to this program. That assistance and so forth still occurs, but it comes from many sources, and it just was outdated language. So that's what the repealer is in line 7.18. And then, as Senator Ferguson indicated, the proposal there is to delete the rules that are part of the program. Those are outdated, and our findings have been that we have not needed those rules because the statutes have been very clear about our direction, and then the appropriation language that comes each year also gives us sufficient direction to not utilize these rules or need these rules.
84 rules, 8400, the 8400 series rules, what do they relate to?
Mr. Chairman, I've got a copy here, but it talks about the details of these easements, which are contained in the easement documents themselves. I mean, so it's language that was instructive when they were originally created to guide what the conservation easement program would look like, but most of the language in the rule now is part of the actual easement itself. You know, the duration, for example, it talks about that. Well, the duration is what the state and the landowner agreed to, and more importantly, what the appropriation language directs the board to do in terms of permanent easements or temporary easements.
So maybe, you know, after we lay the bill over between then and when we take up the environment policy bill, would it be possible maybe for Bowser to just to make a list of what those requirements are that you're seeking to repeal and just maybe send it to committee members as opposed to going through each one now?
Mr. Chairman, I think we certainly can do that. We also would, you know, let you know how we would accommodate any of those provisions in the rule in another fashion, or already are being accommodated either in statute or other provisions.
Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions or comments. And first, on the rulemaking, I think your suggestion is a very good one. I'm not sure. I think what I heard you say is that you are putting these terms into the easement so they don't need to be in the rules. Maybe I misunderstood you.
No.
That is what you said. But that doesn't make a lot of sense to me because, you know, we want to have rules and statutes to give guidance off into the future and not just rely on whoever is writing the easement to set the rules. That's why we have rules, so that they're consistent over a period of time and predictable for the broader public rather than just put into an individual document between two parties. So I guess I would like to see what they all say.
Yeah, let's take a look at them.
And then see if there's a concern about it.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I have a couple other questions and comments. I apologize, I was eating my lunch, but I was listening. On the prices that you're setting or offering for easements on page 5, and it looks like the current practice is that under the current law you set a maximum, and then within that do you negotiate the price? Because what I'm looking at in the new language, it looks like you're going to have a different proposed price in each township because it's based on township average equalized estimated market value. So how will that's not the current practice now, is it, that the price varies from township to township, or can it under current law?
Mr. Jaskie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, yes, it does. And it's because the land values vary from township to township, county to county. And so we use this data, which is we collect from the Department of Revenue, or they give us, and then we've posted all of this with some analysis on the University of Minnesota website. Dr. Steve Tapp is responsible for. We've contracted with them to do so. We can look up, anybody can look up the actual payment rate at the current moment based on that data. And it's important because the principal valuation of an easement is based on the property value. And so we do want to vary it as tightly as we can. And township scale has been deemed to be the most practical.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jaskie, that makes sense. I don't know if we need to be concerned about exceeding some cap. I guess that was that'd be the only thing we'd lose that we have in statute. I have one other concern, if I may.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I just wanted to let you know that these caps and statutes haven't really applied anyways, because if you look on 5.31 and 5.32, an alternative payment system for easements based on cash rent or similar systems. So the board has been operating under Clause 5 for quite a few years now. Those statutory caps that are included, including the percentage amounts, have not applied to this program for many years.
Mr. Chair,
Senator.
Thank you. And one more issue that I want to raise. You have some language at the top of page 6 about standards for prairie restoration or prairie grasslands, wetlands. And I was trying to follow what you were saying about that. I think you suggested that the appropriations language already allows you to do this, but we looked up the appropriations language from 2008 that says, to the extent possible, prairie restorations funded in whole or in part with funds from this appropriation must be made using best management practices for native prairie restoration as defined under 8402. And this is far broader than that. So I'm not sure if I misunderstood you.
Mr. Jaskie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, let me just see if I can clarify that.
Okay.
What we did is use that language that you just read to actually adopt standards. We didn't want to just, because it says, you have some flexibility, but we have to still have some standards. So we adopted standards that said, here's how you, as the person who's doing these projects, can justify that flexibility that the language says. So we've adopted practices and procedures to do that. So this language is not verbatim, but it reflects the way we implemented the language you just read. So I hope that helps.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaskie, I guess I would read these two phrases as really different. I mean, I think what the appropriations language says, to the extent possible, you have to follow these guidelines, which are pretty strict about how, trying to use the most local species possible in restoration. Whereas your new language says you can establish alternative practices without really giving us any guidance about what those would be. It says alternatives to 8402 without saying you're going to follow the guidance of 8402. Instead, you're going to do an alternative. So to me, that's sort of like opening it up to say anything that isn't, we can do anything. To me, it just looks so broad that it kind of swallows the that. Guidance that we're trying to put in law.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, I understand what you're saying, and there's some other language that we might be able to add to this to provide, make sure it's within the confines, but only going outside of it under certain circumstances. And that's what we were trying to do here, is we've adopted these practices to say, Here's the things you have to justify in order to be able to take advantage of that language, because you can't find the seed here, or it's cost prohibitive, or those are the main two reasons. And we require that they look, that they document it, and they report back that they aren't able to secure that seed in those sources. So this reflects the way we have the project sponsors do the work. Hopefully it is following the intent of the statute, but this item, as others have said, may need some more detail to make sure that it is within the confines of the statute. And we've been thinking about that and actually have written a few things down, so we'll be happy to share that with the committee and others when the opportunity presents itself.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaskie, I think the way you explained it, that sounds reasonable to me, that you can make, as long as you're trying to follow the statute, and then if there's problems, if you meet certain criteria for not being able to do it for certain reasons, then you have alternatives. But that's not what this says, so this really does need to be redrafted, I think, to reflect that. I don't get that meaning from this language at all. And so we could work on an amendment. I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, we're coming back to this, so we could try to bring something back later.
We could, and I think...
unless our staff has some ideas.
Whatever members want to do, if we want to talk about this issue more, we're going to have a more extended discussion of this issue on Monday with Senator Stump's bill, so we can get into the ins and outs of native prairie restoration practices. But, you know, maybe, I don't know, Mr. Jasky, without opening a whole can of worms before Monday, tell us about current law and how it's affects your, you know, day-to-day practices.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson's correct. I mean, what we've done is we said the statute applies, and that language gives some authority to deviate from that if you can justify it. And so what we have to do is give people something real literal for them to check the boxes if they are deviating and why they're deviating and how far they're deviating. So we have a record of the changes that they're needing to make that the statute otherwise would require. So that's what this list reflects. Some of the cases where we've seen this are the current statute requires seed source within one of these ecoregion, and I can't talk about it very well without a map in front of us, but it also gives a 20-mile radius from a county boundary to find your seed source. Well, some seeds are quite local and available. Others are very much the same from one part of the state to another. So it depends on the species how important local or really local is. And I'm not the expert in that area, so I have to rely on others that are to tell me that. But we've established a procedure for deviation and justify it. That's what this language reflects. And we'll be listening to and participating in the conversation about Senator Stump's bill, I'm sure, at some point as well.
Has there been an impact on federal funding?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, no, because the state standard is more prescriptive than the federal one. Our standards have been the ones that they've utilized with this flexibility. If we didn't have the flexibility, we might not get the federal cost share to be part of it because they would view it as inordinately expensive or something. But we haven't had to do that because of this flexible language that the Senator Anderson read to us.
Senator Federson.
Mr. Chairman, can I move to a different issue?
Senator Anderson, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No.
We will come back to this. We're going to lay the bill over.
I'll think about ways to draft this.
Yeah. And we'll get into the ins and outs of the native prairie restoration with Senator Stump's bill. We'll have a more extended discussion so people can kind of understand what this issue is about.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Federson.
Mr. Jasky, I'd like to go back to page 3 in that section that allows up to 4 acres of additional land for each acre of wetland that's enrolled into RIM. I believe I'm correct in saying that the federal wetland laws allows up to 6 acres for every 1 acre of wetland. This is permissible language. It says of 4 acres of cropland or 1 acre of non-cropland for each acre of wetland restored. I'm wondering if it would be good for us to go to 6 acres to this, so it parallels the federal.
I'm going to ask Kevin Lyons to come up here just to make sure that, I believe it has not been a problem. 4-1 is quite a sufficient buffer around wetlands in most cases, 4 acres of upland to 1 acre of wetland. And we got to be careful we're going after marginal lands, under this program, so we want to make sure we stick to that. But the question, Kevin, if you heard, was would it be the federal programs allow more than 4-1, and if so, would there be any advantage to adjusting that number upward?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Kevin Lyons, the Conservation Easement Manager for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And Senator Frederickson, your question specifically, USDA's program actually for the Wetlands Reserve Program, which is referring here, allows up to 8-1 in their program guidelines. The RIM program has always been at 4-1. We've not had a problem with that ratio, working in cooperation and collaboration with the federal program. Their program is up to that. Historically, our average easement size when we use those figures is probably closer to 2-1 in actuality, because ultimately, in most instances, the landowner makes a determination on how much land they're interested in enrolling in the program. We rarely rarely do they reach those limits set in the programs across a large geographic area or sign up. But again, the primary purpose in the Wetlands Reserve Program is migratory wildlife, in particular migratory ducks and geese. And so they're looking at that ratio that the native grasslands that are established are the important nesting areas for the birds, and that's why they have a very large ratio there in their program. And we could increase our program ratio, but in fact, landowners are the primary factor determining how much land they're interested in enrolling.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lyons, this is permissive language. It says up to, you know, we could put up to 6 or up to 8, and the board could still say, well, we're going to do 4. But I'm wondering if there's occasionally a parcel that comes along that would be really good nesting habitat for waterfowl where additional acreage would be beneficial. And since this is permissive, why we wouldn't allow the board to have that discretion?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senator Frederickson, you know, I would have no problem with that. In our last partnership with RIMWRP, there were instances where, because of the partnership, USDA responded to our limits of 4-1, so we did put a cap on that, and that would have capped in the size of a particular enrollment. It's a rare occurrence, but it could certainly be an occurrence that we would not be enrolling sufficient high quality nesting cover for the program under this.
Can we change it? Mr. Chairman, your thoughts on this? Should we make a change and see if we get a reaction to it?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I would move on page 3, line 13, strike 4, and insert 8.
Repeat your amendment, please.
Line 13, page 3, delete 4 and insert 8. That would parallel the WRP program.
Okay. Everyone understand the amendment? Let's do it and then see what if there's any opposition that crops up, and we can talk about it more. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Mr. Jasky, anything else?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think we've gone through the bill, and we've got an assignment to get you more details on the rule components that are proposed for repeal, and you'll also be working and listening in on the conversation about the seed source.
This is going to be in there.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being late. Two questions. One is why on page 21 and 22 on page 2, why are we deleting the comprehensive local water plan? I'm sure there's a reason for it.
Mr. Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, it's simply that we're making it more open to other plans that are also out there that identify the riparian lands. They could be a variety of things, and we're just not limiting it to that any longer.
Would it be helpful if you just deleted as defined in section 103B? Are there a comprehensive local water plan? Would that suffice? Provide enough flexibility, or are there other types of plans that you look to?
Mr. Chairman, members, the local plans are the ones that are principally used, but there are others. There could be statewide plans, for example, that use this terminology. There could be other plans that are not specific to this statute, which are the county water plans. There's water district plans or soil and water districts. There's
Are they all water plans in some way?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are. Yes, they are.
Mr. Chairman, it seems like we built that comprehensive local water plan for a purpose, you know, to have local buy-in in terms of those plans. And I mean, I don't know what a comprehensive local water plan would exempt. If there are some things that are not included, then the local water plan ought to be updated.
Mr. Jaski?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, I believe that's they would be. You know, this, I think someone suggested, you know, the specific statutory citation is just for the county plans. We've got watershed district plans that may also be doing that across county boundaries in some certain cases. So we want to allow those to be utilized too. So maybe you can make it less specific, but still retain that local plan as being the place where the priority waters are defined.
You want to mull over it some more? Senator Stumpf, we're going to lay this over.
Right. Okay. I think I think we should discuss that a little bit more. The other one is on page line 21. Is there, and I see that this is existing language, but why do we say at least 5 acres in size?
Mr. Jaski.
Senator Stumpf, I don't have a great answer for this. I don't know, but I'm presuming that it had to do with just the effort it takes to enroll an area in a conservation easement includes a lot of legal work and other things, and I suppose there's a practical size that needed to be put into the statute, although it does provide an exclusion for some areas that are, you know, got certain characteristics. But, you know, Mr. Lyons, do you have any input on that?
Mr. Lyons.
Mr. Chairman, committee member, Senator Stumpf, I mean, I think as Mr. Jaski alluded to earlier, was primarily looking at a cost of administration of that 5 acres. You know, in recent past, almost all of our efforts have been on restoring drained wetland areas and riparian areas and have not even had this category come into play into our program since we've been focusing primarily on restoration of drained wetlands and riparian land enrollment. But when the program was first created, we were looking at highly erodible lands, a lot more full field enrollment, and so at some point you're prioritizing those efforts and looking at larger tracts and not that minimum size limit. So,
yeah, I, Mr. Chairman and members, I can see all kinds of, you know, variation possibilities, in especially in and around the metropolitan area. If you wanted to use that program, the value of the land on a per acre basis would be quite high versus, let's say, in some rural areas where it would be quite low, but so I mean, if it's it seems like it's a limitation on the use of that program, but I can understand there is a kind of a de minimis size where you probably want to maintain it. But 5 acres is a pretty good chunk. I mean, if it's a buffer or if it's something else.
Mr. Lyons?
Mr. Chairman, committee member, Senator Stumpf, I concur with that thinking. I mean, at one point, why would we limit ourselves? We don't know what the future opportunities might be. And so by looking at something being restrictive, that's not necessarily. We do have a board authority to establish the program and what our goals and objectives are. So, I mean, I have certainly, you know, unless my boss here telling me something different, I concur with that thinking.
So there would, you're, Senator Stumpf, you're saying that someone might want to have 1 acre in the RIM program?
Mr. Chairman, no, my thinking is that because when you look at the variation in the values of land, 5 acres in maybe west central Minnesota might be quite a bit in a certain project. I mean, the values out there might be, you know, significant enough to justify, let's say, the legal expenses and stuff. And it might be maybe not practical, let's say, in some other part of the state where you may have bigger, you know, larger acre sizes to justify the legal expense, if that's the rationale.
On the other hand, there might be 1 or 2 acres in the metro that could really provide a lot of benefit.
Correct.
All right, let's think about it. Let's think about it some more. Maybe Mr. Jaski, you could circle back with your board or whatever stakeholder you think would be important. Okay. Further questions on the bill? Senator Rummel, anything else you wanted to add?
No, Mr. Chair. I believe someone on the committee needs to make the motion, lay it on the table.
We don't need a motion. We can, if there's no other discussion, we'll just lay over Senate File 773 for possible inclusion in the omnibus environmental policy bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Phoebe. Mr. Jaski, you just want to stay up there? Senate File 850.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairperson and members. I'm here today with regard to Senate File 850, which has to do with board membership with the Board of Water and Soil Resources Board. It deals with modifying the board membership to include one township officer and 2 elected city officials. One of those must be from a city located in the metro area. And before we go further, I would like to offer an A1 amendment.
We'll pass that out.
Thank you.
Go ahead and explain your amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Chairperson, the A1 amendment on the back side of your bill on line 2.4, there were some changes there that after consulting with a few other entities, we didn't really know why those were put in there and determined that they should be revised. So we ask that you change 5 to 4 members and 7 to 6 members.
Okay, Senator Phoebe moves the A1. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Phoebe.
A few more words on the bill. Currently, the township members and city members have been used as advisory members, and this bill would allow all those stakeholders a stronger voice at the board level with those who are making decisions. It will encourage partnerships and allow local government to have a voice in clean water efforts. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Sulem, the Association of Townships.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And thank you for hearing this bill today. I think it's a pretty straightforward bill, but at the township level, we've had one member who has been in an advisory capacity to Bowser I believe since the beginning, I believe we've had pretty much from the start one person who's allowed to be there but with no official voice or official vote. And for the past three sessions now, we have sought this legislation because of the amount of efforts that we work with Bowser on in terms of wetland mitigation on road projects, drainage ditch issues, the new rules and regulations that will be coming forth in the next couple of years, the potential impact of the constitutional amendment and what that might be doing. We just thought it would be very helpful to have an official voice. We didn't want to kick anybody off. We didn't want to drastically change the structure of Bowser. We simply want to be invited to the adults table for the discussions. In working with our colleagues from the League of Cities, we said, you know, we're seeking this. Is there any sense in putting the cities on? And they said, yes, we appreciate that too. So worked out the language with them. We'd met with the Bowser board, I believe about a year and a half ago that we met. My executive director and I went to a Bowser meeting and walked through their questions and concerns, and this is the end product that we're simply, in light of everything that's coming forward, a chance to be at the official table.
Mr. Jasky? The cities want to speak first? Okay. Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. We do very much appreciate the efforts of the author and the other Senate authors to move this issue forward this year. Cities do have a lot of impact on them from decisions of the Bowser Board. Our stormwater permits that we're federally required to follow are required to be consistent with rules that are adopted by watershed districts. Those rules, if there is any challenge to them, are determined by the Bowser Board. So it's the appeals process for determining what rules cities have to follow for water management. It's also where a lot of the funding for stormwater projects and other non-point source controls come through just the way our state does its funding. So very much support this change. Think it will be very helpful for cities playing a more active role in guiding these decisions.
Mr. Jasky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is not an agency bill. Yes, our agency is neutral on the bill. And be happy to answer any questions. I think the two testifiers spoke to the partnerships that our agency, via the board structure, are set up to accomplish and implement programs. And we've worked with cities and townships in the past, and we will do so in the future, whether this bill passes or not, Mr. Chairman.
How many members of the board are there now, and how many would there be if the bill passes?
Mr. Chairman, members, there are 17 members currently. This would add three to make it 20.
Okay. Because of all the work that Bowser does with local governments, I think it's, you know, very important that they have a seat at the table. Are the counties represented, by the way? Already?
Mm-hmm. Three of them.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The counties have three county commissioners. Soil and water districts have three supervisors, and water districts have three managers, and we have three citizens. And then we have the University of Minnesota as well as the commissioners, representatives of agriculture, health, natural resources, and pollution control. So it's a broad-based conservation interest that are represented there.
And so as a result, I mean, it just makes sense that they be included. I do also want to wonder out loud that at times, not always, there are environmental protections and initiatives that get blocked, and sometimes unreasonably. And I want to make sure that the voice that we're adding with additional local units of government is not offset with with environmental protections being, you know, rolled back or blocked, or some of the good work that Bowser's doing. There was a little bit of consternation with some of the rules regarding wetlands that were being adopted by the board in December. I think that's been ironed out. It's been fine, but, you know, sometimes when those things happen, we start to, some of the work that we do here in the legislature, we start to get concerned about some of that. That's just a rhetorical comment, and just from me. That's all. Additional discussion on Senate File 850. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I'm a little surprised to see that the metropolitan area has such a small minority of the membership. Is that because you don't feel that you're as connected, your work is as connected to the metropolitan area? Mr. Jaski.
Mr. Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, you know, you should remember too, you know, that the geography is described that by these regional areas that members need to be appointed from. So there is broad geographic representation. Again, it's not an agency bill, just so you understand that too. I want to point out that the members who are from the agencies, as well as University of Minnesota, of course, most of them reside in the metro area, but they represent statewide interests. And the townships largely who are being added are, you know, much more rural. And as you can see there, the cities, it does say that one shall be from the metropolitan area. So I think based on the amendment, it looks like the additions would be added proportionally to what's currently in place.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaski, you're right that it's proportionate, but before it was between 3 and 5, and now it's between 4 and 6 out of 20 members so that are required to be from the metropolitan area. I'm just wondering. Why that's appropriate to have not have it be half and half.
Water in the
rest of the okay. I just want to hear an explanation.
Mr. Chairman, and
I might like
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I just so you understand too, you know, the five that represent the agencies at the University of Minnesota aren't representing Metro or Greater Minnesota. So it's really you're talking about 15 is the number you're talking about, I guess, in terms of citizens and local government representatives coming from either Metro or Greater Minnesota. So given that math, I guess it would be 4 to 6 of 15 would be from the metropolitan area.
Yeah. That's
and, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaski, why is that? Is there any particular reason you came up with that proportion? I mean, I guess generally we usually just sort of do things 50-50 unless there's a reason not to, so I'm just wondering why it was set up that way in the first place.
Mr. Chairman, may I help him?
Senator Olson.
There's more soil and more water in Greater Minnesota than there is in the metro area.
I think Anderson.
I guess if we want to call it the Board of Soil, Water, and Asphalt, we could have more city. Mr. Jaski, just kidding.
Senator Olson, I think, said it better than I could.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, maybe it's an appropriate issue to examine. Senator Anderson, if you think there might be some more, a better calculation based on Bowser's work throughout the state geographically, and there would be a better proportion of members, let's think about it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the question I was really asking is there some proportionately more work that's done outside of the metropolitan area? And then if so, that would make sense. But I guess I haven't heard Mr. Jaski say that. So maybe it is, you know, sort of equally the relationship between the board and the local soil and water conservation districts or, the equivalent organizations in the metropolitan area. If those are all equally connected to the work that you do, I guess I don't really understand why we're sort of in a minority position. And maybe there's a good reason for it, but I'm not sure if that reflects the work
Mr.
or
Jaski.
Not.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think it's simply a reflection of the programs are about mm-hmm. the land, you know, the programs are on the land, and we deal with the land. Of course, the people are very much a part of that, too. We've never had it be an issue, frankly, you know, of proportionality. The programs drive their priorities based on the language you give us to work from and the current statute, so it hasn't become an issue whatsoever.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I think I can help a little bit on this in that the amount of work that the board is doing now that relates more directly to cities is increasing very rapidly. With TMDLs being done that are putting specific requirements on stormwater performance and non-point source reductions of pollutant loads, I think it's now that we're seeing a need to get a few more city folks involved. But if you look at what they've historically done, soil and water districts are organized by county. Well, most of the counties are outside of the metro area, so most of the appointees from here would be from outside the metro area. Each county is kind of doing its own work. So I think historically, most of the people working on these programs were from outside the metro area. There's just far more counties out there that each have their own watershed districts or soil and water districts doing this. So I think it is changing over time. I think that's why you're seeing some city reps being added now, and maybe the number will change more now or over time, but I don't think it was an intentional thing to keep. My city folks don't feel they were intentionally being kept out by that formula in the past. It was more a reflection of how much of the work was happening in more rural areas.
The only frame of reference I have is I remember your testimony on RIM, and you said that pretty much only 10% of RIM's money goes to kind of metro projects, but that doesn't mean RIM is the only thing you do. Using that as a frame of reference, is that kind of accurate, or is RIM just a small percentage of what Bowser does?
Mr. Chairman, members, that is one particular program that's focused on marginal agricultural land restoration, so that program in particular would be much more rural. As Mr. Johnson indicated, the Clean Water funding, our Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act program, of course, is totally metropolitan-driven, so the Wetland Conservation Act is basically equal all over the place, so it's that one program is unique.
It's fine.
All right. Well, Senator Frederick.
Chairman, different issue?
Yep. If there's nothing more, I mean, good
whatever.
Bowser discussion. If people have additional thoughts and want to delve into the membership issue and as proportionate to their work, we know who to talk to. Senator Frederick.
Mr. Chairman, when I was reading through this statute and adding up the membership, I was at least momentarily confused between members and ex-officio members, and I think I could clear up that confusion if I would add appointed after 15 and before members. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move on page 1, line 9, after 15, insert appointed.
Ex-officio members are not appointed?
No.
That's correct.
That's my position.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I would be okay with that.
Mr. Jaski?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually trying to remember now that the language that Senator Ferguson is pointing to, the five ex-officio members, I think is a kind of a remnant piece that reflects the time before the agency members were voting members of the board back, a decade or two ago. So,
do you have ex officio members at the moment?
We do, but I don't know. They're not necessarily called out exclusive as to who they are. The townships and cities have always been so. And we've considered them that, but.
No, but those are appointed members.
They are not appointed. They are invited, I guess, is the best way to say it, but have been identified as ex officio.
All right. Okay, I think the Frederickson Amendment is probably good enough. All those in favor? No more discussion? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 850. Seeing none, Senate File 850 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Thank you, Senator Fobey. Hey. What offers do we have? Senator Vickerman, would you like to do Senate File 171? Oh, I'm sorry, you have two bills, Senate File 34 and Senate File 171, whichever you'd like to take first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, both Senate File 34 and 171 kind of commingle each other. I do have some people that did come up. As you know, I'm a trail guy. I love trails. Trails to be connected. Nobody was able to come here from my hometown, but you have people here that can help us explain it. I just want to members to understand neither one are asking for any state funding. Not asking for any state funding. Bill would just simply allow the DNR Trail Division to work with Friends of Jackson County Trail Groups in developing for an extension of the system Casey Jones Trail that we dedicated this last summer. We laid dedicated this leg of the Casey Jones is necessary to complete our goal of establishing a backbone trail to serve all of southwestern Minnesota. The original Casey Jones Trail ran from Lake Chautauqua State Park to Pipestone. It was one of the first trails established in Minnesota back in 1901. In 2000, the Southwest Minnesota Multi-Use Trail Advisory Board began to work on a plan to extend this trail to a little house on the prairie or Walnut Grove. And so, Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 171 reflects the desire of the Advisory Board and Friends of Jackson County Trail to move forward with the next section, segment of our trail. Now, both 171 and 34 commingled. Actually, there they could be just maybe one trail. I mean, one bill. So, why don't be all right, Mr. Chair? You hear from the witnesses here who drove up your at least 3.5-4-hour drive. If they would like to do that, and Mr. We have a this around.
Pass the handout around. Or is there
a handout?
Oh, we got a. Well, that's a big handout. All right. Whatever you prefer. Whoever would like to. We'll just pass that around. We can handle it. Who's the first witness?
I'll be the first witness.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Hope you had a safe drive here.
It was a nice drive this morning. The roads weren't as wet and icy as the last time.
Good.
This is my only second time testifying. We went up to the House and testified in the companion bill. And I do have maps, too, for some. I don't make enough. But these are the trails. Our committee, the Friends of the Jackson County Trails, started back in 1998 as to investigate trails in Jackson County.
Well, and if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, it helps for the tape.
My name is Chuck Lutz.
Thank you.
With the Friends of the Jackson County Trails.
Thank you.
That is spelled L-U-C-H-T.
Thank you.
Why don't address me as Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair?
Nervous. You're doing good.
Yeah. After I got done the last time, I couldn't remember half of what I did. But what we did back in 1989 is start brainstorming where we'd like trails. The maps that are going around show some of the results of the trails that we have developed so far. We've been developing trails through the ATP system of grants, and our county has been very supportive in helping us apply for these trails. The city has been very supportive in helping fund these trails. And now we think it's the next step is to help connect up to the Casey Jones Trail. Last year we built, and this summer you're all invited down to a grand opening of the first trail we know about that connects up from Minnesota to Iowa. We built a trail that last year, it'll be our grand opening ribbon cutting this summer, August 1st. Senator Vickerman will get more notice on this. But we're going to officially join the two states with the Okoboji Trail system you see in the bottom of that map with the Jackson County Trail system that we've already got going. Our trails now, Loon Lake, trails down in that area connect right now two county parks. We have also plans to connect the third one and have been approved for a grant that will be coming up. Right now we've also, the second phase goes from the county parks down to Iowa, and that's what we'll be having the grand opening on. And we've been working at this a little bit at a time, anywhere from 3/4 mile trail to 2 miles last year. And been going along, and what we want to do now, like I said, is connect Iowa with the Casey Jones Trail and go on up to their plans, you know, all over southwest Minnesota too. and we just think it's a great thing. I Googled interstate bike trails last night and found out there's a plan in the country that they were talking about last December to have a whole nationwide trail system. And if we are the first one to be between Iowa and Minnesota, we've got a great start. We've got the trail system started in that area. One of the questions that was asked before, do we have local financial support besides government agency? And our second, our treasurer, Lynn Anderson, has more specifics, but we've had estates that have given $50,000. Local bank gave $10,000, Bank Midwest. We get donations from some of the campers that camp in these campgrounds because they like the trails connecting up. If you want more specific, Lynn's got more of that she can go through. Joanne Asa has got the map and some of the different trails on there also. But we've got, they're also helping Jackson become healthier. I used to ride, one summer I rode 900 miles on a Sears 10 speed. Had a couple of close calls with cars, and I kind of, my mileage went down after that, and my weight went up. But I have a coworker that has lost 135 pounds already walking the trails in Jackson, and another member in town, or another person in town has lost over 100 pounds now. So the one member was... that I work with, or the one person I work with, was very diabetic. His sugar level was always high, and now it's coming down, I heard, on there. So it is a health thing that we look at, too, to connect up some of these things. Personally, I like a good 30 to 40 mile ride on the bike. It gets me through a lot of territory. We've gone on the Sakata Singing Hills Trail from Waterville to Faribault. Of course, we hit the Dairy Queen at the end, but we...
You deserve it at that point.
But then we'd ride back afterwards, so it was... That's a beautiful state trail, and I think along the Des Moines River, we've got the capability of doing the same thing. We've had bike rides every year that raise some money where we get people coming in. We've had people from Colorado and the Twin Cities area come in, ride with us on a... bike ride that goes along the Des Moines River now on one of the roads. When the county updates that road, we plan on putting the trail down across the ditch along there also. That could also be part of that state trail. So other than that, besides the health reasons, we're looking forward to more businesses that deal with trail support, that type of thing. We've got letters from Cottonwood County, Murray County, Jackson County, and on supporting this type of a trail system. We didn't bring Cottonwood County one. It's in our secretary's house when she's locked it up and gone to Arizona to see her daughter. So we couldn't bring that one, but we do have those type of things along if you'd like to take a look at. People are excited. The day after I testified with Representative Hamilton, they started calling me from the paper, and the next week we had front page news article on the paper about possibility of a state trail in Jackson County. So there's a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of excitement about it. If there's any questions, I don't want to talk all day.
Okay, next witness.
Mr. Chair, just to put it in perspective, the second bill that I'm carrying is called the Des Moines River Valley Trail, Jackson, Cottonwood, and Murray. Trail starts in Jackson, the Minnesota-Iowa border, connects with the Dixon Trail and the Minnewanka State Park in Iowa, and then to the greatest extent possible, the trail shall follow the Des Moines River Valley, extending northwesterly through Jackson County to Kylan State Park, through Cottonwood County, into Murray County, and the trail shall terminate at the Casey Jones Trail. In other words, it's a connector when you get to that point.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee. I am Lynn Anderson. I am from Jackson, Minnesota, and I am on the Trails Committee. As a Phi Ed teacher, I've been on this committee since 1999. I see a very much of a need for physical activity in our corner of the state. We have a lot in southeast Minnesota and in the metro area and even northern Minnesota, but our corner of the state, we do not have a lot of recreational trails. Ours is kind of the beginning, and we hope to expand all the way to the Casey Jones. So any help we can get from your committee, we'd appreciate it. Thank you very much.
What kind of trail is it? Is it a asphalt trail or just a gravel? Or?
Asphalt. They're all asphalt.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I'm Joanne Issa, another member of the Friends of Jackson County Trails. And that map that's being passed around is just Jackson County. And then we'll connect with Cottonwood County and Murray County. And you can see the attachment at the bottom. That's the Dickinson County, Iowa Trails. And that's a very developed recreational area. In fact, I've brought along their 2009 book that they put out every year. And, I mean, they'll make a real impact on our trails if we can hook all the way up to Kylan Woods and on. I can see economically it'll be a great impact on our area, too. As long as well as the health reasons and all that.
Well, we don't want to promote them too much, but I could see a lot of opportunity for kind of cross-border events. Jackson to is it the town of Okoboji or Spirit Lake?
Spirit Lake, and Okoboji, yeah. And Milford—they're three little towns together.
Yeah.
And this year we're starting Biking the Border. We'll have a bike ride together. And we think a lot of their people want to get out of that area, especially on weekends because it's so busy. So they'll be coming on up into Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Smith Eisen, was it that you?
No.
I didn't catch your last name. Eisen?
Asa. A-S-A.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Asa. Is the trail in Iowa in place now, or is that being planned?
They have about 60 miles in place, and they have just recently, it's not quite done yet, but they've purchased a rail bed, and they'll be expanding their trail system. They have ongoing plans all the time. It's a big trail system down there.
I have a fair amount of in-laws near the Emmitsville, Grettinger area. It's not too far from Okoboji, and I think we take 71 down. I think that's the way we get down there. So, okay. The DNR want to comment? Okay. So. Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Hoot?
Lutz.
Mr. Chair.
One thing about it, we've been working with the DNR on a couple of other projects for the trails already as far as we applied with the DNR for shoreline restoration grants 3 years ago, I think, was the first one. We planted 8,000 plants of native grasses, native flowers along the river, along the trail that runs in Jackson. And the people just thought that was beautiful. And a couple of our members who aren't here today, that's their thing. They love rain gardens. They love the shoreline restoration. And we just set them on that, and they kept it watered all summer. And probably that watering did, it was a dry summer, and probably that watering did make that planting. And last year we put another one in. Wasn't quite as big as the first year. But so along that trail we've brought a lot of plantings in. The one trail is built on the dike system that helps flood control. And so you're above the river and you're looking out over the river as you go along here to these plantings. And it was one of the DNR was very happy with what we had done with that along there because they approved the second grant right away. And the ATP has been, our trails have been one of the top ones in Mankato area for the last number of years.
Okay. All right. So there's no potential fiscal impact on this?
As far as
the legislation or any of the department activities, Mr. Knopf?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what this does is it makes it a state trail. It does kind of make a promise in the future that at some point the state will actually put down pavement or whatever on the trail. Basically, by putting it in statute, it makes it eligible for that funding through the, and the commissioner actually operates these trails. This would be a state trail. But there's no immediate fiscal impact. I mean, it's only until the trail is done, and that's usually in the bonding bill. It does make it eligible for the bonding bill in the future for future money. For
so this is just kind of a policy eligibility proposal. All right. Okay. Any other discussion? Senator Vickerman, do you prefer to move these bills on their own, or would you like to lay it over for inclusion in our omnibus bill? It's certainly up to you.
Mr. Chair, I believe in the House they went separate, I think.
Can go to finance.
I can't tell you.
I think they went to finance in the House.
There's no money involved. It just gives them, puts them on the potential list sometime to do it. I would prefer, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, the committee, that I would just send them both alone.
Okay.
Then if we think we need to do something between now and the time that I would bring it up on the floor, we could.
Okay. All right. So I'm not hearing that this needs to go to finance. All right. So Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 34 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Mr. Chair, at the same time, 171, they're both.
I thought we would just do two separate motions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, couldn't these bills be combined?
They could.
Have them both in one bill. They both deal with some of the same counties.
Okay. All right. Would you like to move to amend Senate File 171 into Senate File 34?
Mr. Chairman, I would.
Okay. Everyone understand the Fredrickson Amendment? Is that all right with you, Senator Vickerman? That way you just deal with one Senate file.
That's fine.
On the Fredrickson motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. So then back to the Vickerman motion to send Senate File 34 to the floor.
As amended.
As amended. Senator Sharon.
I'm just back. I'm sorry on the amendment. I voted for the amendment. I wonder if in the House they were moved forward separately if we create a problem by putting it into one. We don't?
Probably not, because once Senate File 34 matches up with its companion, the House can certainly choose to accept what we've done. All right. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Lynch, thank you for your patience.
Cut Jim's work.
Senate File 983.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am here with Senate File 983, and I'm here on a technicality and ask for your indulgence. This is the Great River Ridge Trail redesignation. And let me give you a little bit of background. In 2006, legislation was passed that designated the Great River Ridge Trail.
Mm-hmm.
The language went on to include that the trail would officially be designated after the Wabasha County Regional Rail Authority entered into an agreement with the commissioner of the DNR and submitted the proper paperwork.
Ms. Herring.
Through a series of unfortunate events, there were a number of staffing changes at the county level. The paperwork was never filed. The legislation indicated that the paperwork needed to be submitted by the first day of the next regular session after the law passed. Fast forward, in 2008, in the bonding bill, an appropriation was made, $1.5 million, to create this Great River Ridge Trail. And design has begun, and we were cruising right along, and then it, Wabasha County and the DNR became made aware of the fact that that paperwork had not been processed. There, in fact, was an agreement reached, and paperwork was supported between Wabasha County and the DNR, but the official filing never took place with the Secretary of State's office. And again, for no reason other than the fact that through the transitions that the county encountered,
that step wasn't completed. It is critical that we rectify this situation so that, frankly, design and continued work on that trail can resume and we can have people working on the trail this spring and biking on the trail very soon. And I have with me today Ron Pugger from the DNR, should the committee have any questions regarding this situation.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm just kidding. Senator Fredrickson.
Chairman, I have a great deal of sympathy for this bill because several years ago, a city in my district that had a TIF district established forgot to follow through and mobilize the Secretary of State's office, a city now in Senator Sharon's district. I understand. I would move that Senate File 983 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor, unless you want to put it in. Does it go on the
Sounds like there's a timing issue with this.
So Mr. Chair.
Your motion is proper, I think. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you.
Seeing no further business before the committee, meeting's adjourned.
I announced it at this morning's caucus. People have left. Are we set? I did say that you were singing, so that was going to bring out more people.
Only if it shows up.
Good. Don't lie to me then. No, I didn't say that.
I was.
Someone see it?
No. I should. I've always been advised to go.
Forgot to take them, and they're all at home yet.
The only time I stopped in Jackson.
I didn't take
it personally.
Because, you know, I didn't eat breakfast at home, and you're supposed to take them with food.
Tell me the time I'm done with them.
Super Bowl Sunday, 1990.
That's right, I didn't take them with me. I should have brought them with me.
I had to go to the bathroom story just for the Super Bowl Sunday.
And there it all is yet.
And I went, okay.
Anyway. Oh, yeah, that's the first Southwest you get.